I'm with this Monday, the cast and director of Tenderly, the Rosemary Clooney musical, which opens at the Parish Theater on Friday. It's a production of the Kalamazoo Civic Theater. And I'd like to welcome marketing director Janet Gover, actors Hal Hobson and Mary Teutsch, and director Gregory Moore. Welcome to WMUK.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kara.
To begin, I'll ask Janet to give us the outline of the production and any notes for listeners who might be interested in pursuing tickets to the show.
Absolutely. We are very excited to open our first musical in the Parish Theater this season. And this one, it's kind of one of those small, intimate musicals that will take you back in time and refresh your memory of some of the great music that Rosemary Clooney brought to the world. And it opens this Friday and plays through the 25th. Right? Sunday the 25th. So 3 weekends. And I need to tell everybody that tickets for this weekend are nearly gone. And I would get on the horn right away because I think this is going to be one of those very special pieces of theater, help you get through the winter.
The box office just opened and it stays open until after 5?
Till 5 o'clock this evening. It will be open every day this week, 10 to 5, and the number is 343-1313. And you can always buy tickets online at kazoocivic.com. It's kazoocivic.com. And happy to help you out with your ticket purchase. This is general admission seating, so it's a little different. You're not assigned a seat in the Parish Theater if you haven't been there. So we urge everybody to get there. There's not a bad seat in the house, 190 seats. So you'll be up close and personal to see Mary Teutsch become Rosemary Clooney.
You'll be able to pick out your own seats as well.
That's
when
right.
You go to kazoocivic.com, it will show you all the available seats, and that's sometimes fun
right.
when you're shopping. Gregory Moore, you are a stranger to me. I don't think we've had a chance to talk on the radio before, but I do know you come from a ridiculously talented family, and I'm thrilled to meet you now, and I'd like to hear about you taking on this job of directing this musical at the Parish Theater.
Well, thank you, Kara. It's lovely meeting you, too. I've been waiting for this. Well, I'm from Kalamazoo, from Portage, but I left. Well, I'll put it this way. Jimmy Carter was in office at the time, so I have been in New York and Los Angeles for a long time. But last year, I came back. So I'm living back in the Kalamazoo area and very happy to be back where my family is. You said my ridiculous family?
What? Ridiculously talented.
Oh, that's what it was. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I was asked by the Civic to make my return. Just so you don't think that I'm 900 years old, I was in the youth theater when I last was at the Civic, so if that counts for anything. But yeah, it's been quite a while, so coming back in the role of director is very special to me, and I'm really enjoying the experience. I've got a lot of experience. I had my own orchestra in New York, and we only played 1930s music. Gregory Moore and his Cosmopolitan Orchestra were still more or less around. We're in my garage right now. I was asked, I believe, because of my experience with the music that was Rosemary's bread and butter. It was the Gershwin, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter songbook. And I believe I was brought on because of my knowledge of this era of music.
Greg, what was your instrument?
Oh, I was the singer. I conducted and I led.
Like Rudy Valli.
Exactly.
So do you consider yourself kind of a scholar? I mean, you have to do a lot of research being a band leader.
Yes, not to toot my own horn, but yeah, that's always been my MO. I'm a research wonk. I really believe in reading, listening, just delving into the subject at hand as deeply as I can, because I want to know the real story behind the story.
Do you consider yourself a lyrics-oriented person or a tune-oriented person?
I think I'm more of a tune-oriented person,
actually. That hook has to get you.
Yeah, although the lyrics are equally as important. I always like to know which came first. You know, did Ira write the lyrics and then George wrote them? But yeah.
In what ways did your period ensemble work like the ensembles of the 20s and 30s? Did you move around? Did you have to, you know, make your way and make your living in a similar way?
Well, we only played in New York, various venues, and they're disappearing by the day, I'm sad to say. It's a fairly esoteric era to only do music from the 20s and 30s. My orchestra is 12 pieces, which is doesn't move easily.
No.
So, but we did play most of the big rooms in New York. We played at the Rainbow Room, the Algonquin Hotel, the Plaza Hotel, Lincoln Center, where we got the Dorothy Loudon Award in 2009, I think it was, for perpetuating the music of the 20s and 30s. So we built, we had a name for ourselves there. And if there was a room that could accommodate us, we played it.
Did you find yourself crossing paths with other bearers of the tradition, other flame keepers?
Yes, and a small secret, but we all had the same musicians because they're
yeah.
it's such an sort of, like I said, esoteric. No, maybe that's not the right word. Just sort of, what did you say?
A niche interest.
A niche interest. That's a good way of putting it. So there was, I used to joke that there was one pool beneath Times Square where the, like, 36 musicians just hung out and then just played the various gigs around town. But with the closure of live music venues in New York and all over America, unfortunately, there is still a small but very fervent group of musicians that specialize in this music. And on the same token, there's a, not even a small group, it's called the vintage community, people who dress, who some of whom their entire lives are take place in the 30s, their homes, their cars, their clothing. They refuse to have microwave ovens, things like that. And I got to say, I was one of them. I had a microwave, but I generally dress vintage on most occasions.
Tried to turn it on like a television or something.
I didn't have a television.
Oh, of course, no television.
Just kidding. Yes, I did.
Well, that's a fascinating history, Gregory Moore. Gregory Moore is directing the Rosemary Clooney musical called Tenderly. It starts on Friday, and I allowed myself to get a little off topic so I could dig out your story, which is just so fascinating. And yes, you are going to bring such a wonderful sense to this stage piece. Again, it's at the Kalamazoo Civics Parish Theater, and you can find tickets online at kazoocivic.com or at the box office number 343-1313. Mary Teutsch is a very experienced actress and singer. You've had roles from supporting roles to lead roles, and every time you jump in with a willing spirit and a willingness to be raw often and naked.
Thanks.
So, Mary, what attracted you to the Rosemary Clooney musical?
Well, you know, I've had the good fortune to be able to sing the music from this era in her time in some different shows, and it's a style that I've always really enjoyed singing in, and I've really enjoyed Rosemary Clooney. I'm a fan. So when I found out that there was this musical that would sort of sit nicely in my voice and was a topic I was interested in, I was excited to try and take part in it.
I think this is an interesting era, as Greg was referring to, because the rock and roll revolution had yet to happen, and yet there were true pop stars. Mm-hmm. Extremely famous, you know, touring and just as big as Elvis would later be.
Yeah.
And Rosemary became one of them. And she has a rags to riches kind of story to her. Maybe you could talk a little about her early experiences, what you know about them.
Yeah. Well, she grew up in Maysville, Kentucky, and she
learned to take care of herself really early on because her parents weren't around that much. One thing I thought was interesting in the book was that she did have a lot of family. She had good relationship with her siblings and some aunts and uncles who would pop in and out of the picture. But for most of the part, she just learned to be very independent and take care of herself. And I think that's something that sort of led to her having that drive and ambition to seize the opportunities and become the star that she was. She started in a radio station, probably a lot like this one, just singing the late night radio shift with her sister. And then from there, they met Tony Pastor, who was a big band leader. And then that led to her signing with a larger, more prominent agent in New York. And from there, it was just sort of to the moon.
Was she paving the way? Maybe Gregory could help us with this. Were there other, she was part of a sister act to begin with. Was this something that agents had identified as a valuable thing, and we need this label, our label needs its own sister act, or, you know, how sometimes boy bands and things multiply like this?
Well, the genesis of the sister acts was really the Boswell sisters in the 1930s. And they had a very short career because two of the sisters, there were three, didn't want to do it anymore. They got married and had kids and left the one sister, Connie Boswell, who became a big solo act on her own. But when they dropped off, then came the Andrews sisters, and they picked up the mantle and basically stole their act. But they had an open field, so why not? And with the Andrews sisters in World War II, who were hugely popular, led to some other sister acts, the DeCastro sisters and the Clooney sisters. So the late 40s was sort of, it was a lull in the sister period. In the 50s, it started to pick up a bit more with the McGuire sisters and some of the other girl groups, as they started calling them. They were definitely riding a wave.
So it was a conscious business decision in a way, as well as you're already performing with your sibling. So
most of the big bands in the mid 20th century had vocal groups on the roster, or a soloist. As I said, they would sometimes either have a male trio or. In the 30s, it was male combos, but then it became female singers in the 40s and 50s.
Last Friday, when I knew we'd be preparing for Monday's interview, I sat down and listened to a whole scad of Rosemary Clooney songs, and they really run the gamut from early in her career in the 1950s, as you mentioned, to the 1990s. And early in her career, there's a song that stood out called Sisters, and she sings it with her sister Betty. And I thought we'd take a break to hear that right now and remind listeners that Tenderly, the Rosemary Clooney musical, we will hear that song as well, is coming up this Friday and continues through the 27th of January at the Parish Theater. Mary Teutsch is the lead role as Rosemary Clooney. Hal Hobson plays, I believe, 10 various roles as a partner, and Gregory Moore is directing. We'll be back with the cast and director after we hear Sisters.
Sisters, sisters, there were never such devoted sisters. Never had to have a chaperone, no sir. I'm here to keep my eye on her. Caring, sharing, every little thing that we are wearing. When the mister who comes between me and my sister, and Lord help the sister who comes between me and my man. Sister, don't come between me and my man.
That's Rosemary Clooney and her sister Betty with the song Sisters, and a lot of folks out there would recognize the song. It was also featured in a famous film called White Christmas, and if you just tuned in during the music, we are examining the life and career of Rosemary Clooney. It's the subject of Tenderly, the Rosemary Clooney musical, which starts this Friday at the Parish Theater, a presentation of the Kalamazoo Civic. Details at kazoocivic.com, and 343-1313 is the box office number. Gregory Moore is directing this musical, and during the music, you know, we kept talking about various aspects of the time period and the fact that Rosemary would have been about 24 when she recorded this song.
Yeah, that's about right.
Now, how did she get involved with this famous movie, White Christmas? Anybody?
Well, I think on her reputation alone, she was one of the big recording artists of the early...
She had already established that?
Yeah, okay. In the early 50s. She was signed to Columbia Records, which Mitch Miller was the head of. And he was famous for a lot of the novelty songs of that era, like How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, and Mambo Italiano. And she really became a huge star then. And when they were casting White Christmas, I have read that Irving Berlin himself was fond of her voice and put in a good word for her, because of course he wrote all the music for it.
When we hear, you mentioned Mambo Italiano, I, for some reason, passed over that song, but I grabbed Come On to My House, which has that same sort of Italian flavor to it. When you're listening to her voice, I hear great maturity, even though she's in her 20s. She's confident. And she can deliver a song. She's not fragile or asking you to help her out. She can give it to you and then some, it sounds like. Is that something that appeals to you, Mary?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and that's sort of one thing that I've always liked about her, too, is that she's a very strong personality. And reading her autobiography, it just becomes very clear that she always was very driven and ambitious. She was comfortable in herself for the most part, and she knew what she wanted, and she would figure out how to get it. So, yeah, she was a very strong-willed woman.
I'd like to ask Hal Hobson about playing various supporting roles to Rosemary Clooney. You've also had to look at her life, understand where she's coming from, and, you know, adapt your characters to react to that.
It's been a great acting challenge. Yeah, I play 10 different characters, and one of them is her mother. So and we have some horn rim glasses that I put on, cat eye glasses. And so there's all sorts of variety. It shifts very quickly, though, so it's not a matter of a full costume change, more like a hat or glasses or things that suggest a character, and then we're back into the prime scene again. But yeah, it's been a great challenge for developing contrast between the characters, and some are historical characters that I play, and some are just people that are, you know, figure into her story in life. But I play Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra, and get to sing as Bing Crosby. That's a real joy. That's probably my favorite part of the show. But so yeah, it's very interesting to tell the story from many different angles and different perspectives, and then also travel through probably, what, 50 years of her story, 40, 50 years of her story, and the ups and downs that she went through.
Would you tell us the framework, how we do jump from place to place in her story?
Mm-hmm. Well, one major element of her story is that she really struggled hard with drug addiction. She was addicted to sleeping pills, and later on in her life, through a failed marriage and a lot of difficulties and struggles and people taking advantage of her and stuff, she really kind of disappeared off the map for a while. And so the premise is a psychiatrist who's helping her through these addictions and struggles in Los Angeles. And he's a psychiatrist that works in L.A., so he's used to working with other famous people and celebrities and movie stars. And he's kind of not taken by her celebrity status, and he's able to kind of break through and help her to come to terms with herself and resolve some issues. And so as she's talking and telling stories from her childhood and about her parents and her different marriages, we do flashbacks into those scenes and then back into the psychiatrist's office again. So it's very flowing, though. There's really no scene changes. No scenery moves around. It's more just a shift of lights and we're into another thing and then back into the main scene again. And so it's really interestingly written to create that flow. But I think it's also written in a way that the audience will follow and understand where we are now and who she's talking to. But I play two different of her husbands. And Jose Ferrer was one of her husbands, the actor.
Right.
And not a great husband, I would say. And also kind of a known womanizer, known for his sleeping around.
Didn't she marry him twice?
She married him twice. She married him and got divorced for a few years and then finally said, oh, I can't take this anymore, and went back and married him and then later divorced him again. But then her second husband was later in life, and she stayed with him until she passed away. And that was a very good marriage from all accounts. It was loving and kind. And he was one of her dance instructors, one of her choreographers. And finding the background of all these, and like with Bing Crosby, he was already an established star. You were to ask about White Christmas. That song was already huge. It was the number one hit of all time at the time. And sold more records than any other record. And so then they said, well, since it's so big, let's maximize on this and make a movie out of it. It was about 3 or 4 years later. And like I said, Irving Berlin was very nervous about that because he didn't want to ruin his song. And they turned to him and said, you know, there's nothing you can do to ruin this song. Everybody already loves it. We're only going to add more background to it and sell more copies of it. But he would not have been famous had it not been for radio, because prior to Bing Crosby, the real element of a male voice that people loved was a high tenor, the Caruso and the operatic tenors. And when radio came along, that did not translate well because of the tubes in the radio. When you sang high in that tessitura, it sounded very scratchy and very abrasive, and it didn't come across the radio well. And when he came along with a crooner voice, more of a baritone range, that really translated to radio, and people
said,
"Oh,
liked it."
Yeah, because he's not a trained singer. He doesn't have an excellent voice. He's just a good singer. Bing Crosby can put across a song well, but his voice isn't a trained voice. And people fell in love with his voice, and really, radio had a lot to do with that. And from that point on, people shifted away from the high tenor more to the crooner range.
It just worked so well. Mm-hmm. And that was Rudy Valley's thing too. He had a softer sound that was brought out.
Yeah, I've written nine shows, written, directed, and performed in. One of them was called Croon, and it was the history of the early recordings and how the crooners came about. It's been said that the microphone was actually their instrument. They didn't play an instrument, but the microphone was, because before the microphone came about, which was at the same time that radio came about, one couldn't be heard singing lightly and softly. So Bing Crosby, Rudy Valley, and Russ Columba was the third of the triumvirate. They were absolutely revolutionary to hear these soft crooning sounds over the air. The ladies went wild. Men reportedly hated the crooners. They famously thought they were like wives stealers and all this. So it was a fad. The crooners were a fad. It lasted only about 3 years, and before they became passé, and then they became sort of reviled and a joke. But Bing was the only one that really survived the advent, or the crooning era, I should say.
Right.
Russ Columba was accidentally shot by his best friend in the face at the age of 24. And Rudy Valley, he continued to have a career in movies, but not nearly the popularity he had in the early 30s. But Bing, many would argue that he was the greatest star of the 20th century in many ways, recording, movies, radio.
He was diversified.
Yeah, oh, yeah, television.
Yeah, yeah. What a fun discussion this is. We're talking about the life of Rosemary Clooney, which is the subject of Tenderly, the Rosemary Clooney musical. It starts at the Parish Theater on Friday, and it's a presentation of the Kalamazoo Civic. And here's a basic question for you, Gregory. What's the proportion of story to music on stage that we'll see this weekend?
It's fairly evenly distributed. I'd guess maybe 60-40 dialogue to music.
So you break into song fairly often.
Yeah.
60-40? Yeah, there's quite a bit of music in this. We get a sampling of most of her greatest hits, actually.
So. Would you set up the circumstances under which she recorded Come Out of My House? You mentioned Mitch Miller before.
Yes. She was actually... she didn't choose her own songs. In that era, she and Frank Sinatra were both under contract to Columbia Records. Mitch Miller was famously an autocrat, and he ran a very tight ship. And if you didn't like it, you could take a hike. So more or less, she sang what he put in front of her. And that was one of the songs that he proffered to her, and she abided by it.
Was she resistant to this song, or?
Yes, she was. she was even known as another one of her songs was Baciame, which means kiss me in Italian. And I guess they could both be called novelty numbers in that they were sort of outside the realm of just the normal pop tunes of the day. They were sung with humor, and they always had a bounce to them, and they were incurably catchy.
In this case, there's someone like swinging on a harpsichord.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
It's pretty wild, yes, the swinging harpsichord. She was resistant, but I think toward the end, she came to terms with the early songs. Earlier in her career, she was very resistant, but I think she learned that that's what the audience came to hear, and they wanted to hear Mambo Italiano, Baciame.
Come Out of My House.
And Come Out of My House. Those were her bread and butter songs, and she always did them as encores. But toward the end, after her rediscovery, she more preferred to sing the songs that she wanted to sing, but she included them in the finales.
Come on to my house, in my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, in my house, I'm gonna give you apple, plum, and apricot, do I? Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you figs and dates and grapes and cakes, eh? Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you peach and pear, and I love your hair, eh? Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you East Side. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you everything, everything, everything. Come on to my house.
Well, that's Rosemary Clooney with one of her big hits in the 1950s, Come On to My House. And we're with the cast of Tenderly, the Rosemary Clooney musical, as well as marketing director for the Kalamazoo Civic, Janet Gover. And I'm going to ask you once again to remind listeners of how to track down their tickets and any other interesting details.
Absolutely.
We haven't mentioned yet.
To get tickets, call the box office between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. There's somebody live there to talk to at 343-1313, or you can always get them online 24 hours, kazoocivic.com. And we were talking while the song was playing, this is actually a Southwest Michigan premiere, this production of Tenderly. Nobody around here has done it theater-wise. It's been done on the east side of the state and in many theaters across the country and in London. But we're very excited to be able to bring this to you. And the authors of this production, Janet Yates Vogt and Mark Friedman, are out of Cincinnati, Ohio. And they also were the writers, creators of two of our youth theater productions a few years ago, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and the Sherlock Holmes and the Mystery of the Crown Jewel. And those were actually premiered at the Civic through our youth theater production, where we actually worked with Mark and Janet to make those shows happen. This one we're not premiering, but it's a premiere for Southwest Michigan, if you would. So we're very excited to be able to bring their work to Kalamazoo audiences again.
Earlier I mentioned that, Gregory, you come from a talented family, and I'm wondering if you got the chance to see your sister, Lori Moore, starring at the beginning of the Kalamazoo Civic season.
I sure did, opening night, and then I went back two more times.
It must be kind of a thrill.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, did she come out to New York to hear your orchestra?
Many times, yeah. I performed every summer at something called the Jazz Aged Lawn Party, which draws 25,000 people per summer. And Lori would come out. Everyone dresses in 1920s garb. It's outdoors, overlooking the Manhattan skyline. So she made several glamorous appearances there.
Would you tell me about what got you into this vintage frame of mind, this love for the popular music of the 20s and 30s?
I've always, since I was a kid, best loved the music of the 30s. Most of my career, I actually spent in opera in New York. I sang at the Metropolitan Opera, New York City Opera, Los Angeles Opera. But my real love was always the great American songbook of the earlier part of the 20th century. And I sort of did a major shift, just said, enough opera, I want to try going my own way.
And was there a period where you were booked for, you know, productions of opera, but you in between would create recitals of American song?
Not really. I had to make a full-fledged shift. I just said, okay, doing something new now. I'm not sure quite what it is about the aesthetic and the sound of the 30s that attracts me most. I think it was such a definite style that was in a specific period. I like how the women dressed. I liked how the men dressed. I love the cars, the Art Deco. Just everything about that era really appeals to me. And I've always felt, not to make too big a thing out of it, but I felt sort of a responsibility that if someone doesn't take the mantle and carry on these traditions, you know, it will just be buried by the sands of time. And these songs will, many of which already are totally forgotten, some of the music, the musicians of that era. And I feel a real responsibility somehow to carry on the torch and hopefully hand it on to the next generation that will discover and be thrilled by this music as I am.
It is thrilling. I love the recordings of this era because generally they're all one takes in one room. And you can visualize even more than you can with recordings of today exactly what's happening and how the performance came over and everyone worked together.
I like them warts and all. I mean, even when you hear the mistakes, it's like, well, yeah, that's how it sounded, you know.
Well, we should mention again that the Rosemary Clooney musical opens on Friday, and I'd like to maybe talk a little more to Mary, who is Rosemary for the next few weeks at the Parish Theater. What else can we talk about in the preparation for this role? You had to get into her sound, and was it physically challenging at all?
Kind of, because it is... I mean, it's one thing to be able to create a character that nobody has any reference for, you know, out of fiction and imagination, but it's a whole different beast to have to base your entire performance on someone who was a living, breathing person who there's so much video and audio documentation of, where I remember in the beginning weeks, it kind of stressed me out because I just thought, like, I'm trying so hard to sound like this person who had not an entirely different voice, but, you know, people just don't sound identical very much. But eventually I just did a lot of research and I realized I just have to just try and hold on to what she sounded like, her gestures and stuff, but still sort of bring that into myself and tie them together to make an honest performance versus just an impression of Rosemary Clooney, which is not something people would want to see in the long run. So, yeah, it's been a lot of research. I read her autobiography. I've spent a lot of time on YouTube. And, of course, like, everyone in the rehearsal room has been doing that, Gregory and our music director, Lori and Hal. And we all come in with our own little stories and tidbits we've learned and exchange them to sort of inform what we're doing.
You know, what I saw when I was watching her videos on Friday is her rhythmic sense is terrific. She is confident.
And her phrasing is something she's very well known for. And yeah, she really knew how to work a lyric and find out what it meant to her and share that with her audiences.
And she worked with good musicians, too. Mm-hmm. There is a live band for this musical. There's a bassist I know named Mark Tomlinson. and you have keyboard and...
Lori Hatfield is our musical director.
Lori Hatfield, terrific. She's a very experienced music director, so...
She's wonderful.
Keith Hall from Western's our drummer.
Oh, let's... just so that everyone can hear that, let's hear you say that again.
The drummer for it is Keith Hall, who is a professor of jazz drums here at Western, and fantastic, just great to work with.
Goodness gracious, you couldn't ask for better.
Yeah, it's a great trio.
Yeah. Well, this sounds like it's going to be a knockout. It starts on Friday and continues through the 27th. We should talk about her most famous song, Tenderly. I don't really know who wrote it or how it came into her... repertoire. It seems to have been there for a long time from the beginning of her career, the early 50s. What can you tell me, Gregory?
Well, you know, you got me on the spot. He was not a one-hit wonder, but this was his only really famous song. He was a pianist, and I'm drawing a blank on his name. Is it Billy? No, it's not Billy Barnes. In any case, he had this one hit, Tenderly, and it's still one of the great standards of the 20th century. I heard an interesting story relating to the song Tenderly. As I mentioned, he had this big hit, and then he fell somewhat on hard times. And I heard firsthand from someone who was there that they were in a joint in New York. I think it was in the 50s or 60s, and the composer of the song was playing in this sort of rundown joint, and in walks Frank Sinatra, who sat and requested Tenderly and then sang it at the piano with him and then deposited a $100 bill into his tip jar. And there's a bootleg recording of that that I've listened to. Frank was a good guy. Contrary to popular belief.
Right. He helped a good man when he was down.
Yes. And he was also very helpful to Rosemary Clooney. He was, he tried to put her on the right path. I mean, he had many problems of his own, but he, as illustrated in our show, he does appear throughout her life telling her, you got to get off the drugs, you need to give up the pills. Both he and Bing Crosby were, I think, shining avatars in her life that appeared throughout. And Bing actually appeared later in her life after she'd had a full nervous breakdown. She had been hospitalized for her addictions and mental illness. And he really was instrumental in bringing her back. And our show has a very happy ending. I mean, we take her from her youth through her hard times, but I want to tell the audience, you'll leave with your toe tapping, because it does have a very happy ending.
She was
I don't mean to be a spoiler,
lady.
But no one dies.
Is it time to hear Tenderly, I think?
I think so.
Okay. Well, shall we hear early Rosemary or mature Rosemary?
Yeah, well... If you can't do both, I would say the early one.
Okay. All right. I'm with the cast and director of Tenderly, the Rosemary Clooney musical, which opens on Friday. The tickets for this weekend are quite scarce, but you can find out more if you call the box office at 343-1313 or visit the website kazoocivic.com. That's K-A-Z-O-O civic.com.
Thank you.
tenderly.
Well, there she is with Tenderly. That's Rosemary Clooney, her first recording in the early 50s. And she would have many life changes from her really big first hits, this peak in the 50s, through very low points. But as my guests mentioned, her strength and work and friendships with great people kind of brought her back and brought her back to stage so we could all enjoy her performing once again. Here in the studio with me at WMUK are Mary Teutsch, who plays Rosemary Clooney, Hal Hobson, who is her scene partner as 10 different people. Gregory Moore is the director of this production, bringing a great experience as a musician as well as a director. And Janet Gover, marketing director from the Kalamazoo Civic. Details online at kazoocivic.com. Let's finish up with final thoughts about this. Maybe you can talk directly to listeners who just need a night out. What are some of the other things we can intrigue them with, perhaps? Gregory?
Well, we're hoping to reach across the board to attract all kinds of audiences, not just people who may remember her. We'd like to expose new people or younger people to her as well. She had a very interesting life. It's a real testament to strength of character that she overcame many obstacles and really hit rock bottom and was able to, through her doctor and through her her own strength of character, I think most of all, learn to overcome many odds that were against her, including a change in musical taste where she became more or less considered passé or yesterday's news. But after quite a while off, she was able to bounce back and show a new audience that she had the stuff, she had the goods, and really became an exemplar of the American songbook of the 20th century.
She really did. Yeah. Mary, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, pretty much what Greg said in a nutshell. I think one thing that we didn't really mention is that today most people just know that Rosemary Clooney was George Clooney's aunt.
Yes.
And I think that people should just come out to sort of learn more, because she was a huge star in her own right. Her career spanned several decades, and she was just, I think it's a really interesting story, and she was a really amazing person to sort of know more about and learn from, because she never gave up. And I think that's inspiring.
I suspect that's why they brought me on board, because I could understand she was George Clooney's aunt. I'm Laurie Moore's brother. Corollary.
Yeah, just instinctive understanding there. Hal?
Well, this past year through the Gilmore, we went to see the Liberace musical down at Farmer's Alley Theater. And I know when we went there, we expected it to be mostly piano playing and music element. And then we were so surprised by how much of a play it was, and really structuring his life and giving the background of what he went through. And I think it's the same thing here. The same idea of it really is a play. It's not just a review of music, although you'll hear lots of wonderful songs and all kinds of recognizable pieces. But the interrelationship and character development and the storyline that happens, and lots of nods to things of the 50s, 60s, 70s as she goes through her life that will bring back a lot of memorabilia and recollection. But it's beautifully written, and it's a really enjoyable piece of theater, as well as a great concert of wonderful songs.
And I'll give Janet the final word here.
Yes, well, looking at the ticket sales for this weekend, I would urge everybody to get on the horn and order tickets soon. We play three full weekends, so Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and that's just going to be one I think you'll long remember after you leave the theater, after the happy ending.
Yes. Toe-tapping.
Toe-tapping.
Well, thank you all for coming in and sharing your thoughts about what went into this production and what your hopes are for the full run, which is Friday through January 27th at the Parish Theater. It's the small space, so you'll get up close with Rosemary Clooney and her ups and downs. Thank you, Greg and Mary and Hal and Janet. And we'll leave you with some music from Rosemary. This is Straighten Up and Fly Right.
Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Ain't no use in diving. What's the use in diving? Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. The buzzard told the monkey, you are choking me. Release your hold and I will set you free. The monkey looked the buzzard right dead in the eye and said, your story's so touching, it sounds like a lie.